accuracies of order 10%, and so for astronomical work, that's usually the best you can hope for, given that people have a difficult time measuring things that accurately even. So what I want to start, first let me give you an outline about what I'm going to do today, and we'll see how far I get. So I'm first going to start off just by reminding you of hydrostatic balance, because that really calls the shots for stars, and in some sense how hydrostatic balance, and I'm just going to sketch things, tells us something about the virial theorem. That's the first part. The second part then is why stars have the mass they do. Why do they have this range? Let me just tell you what the range is. This is the solar mass. Stars come roughly in a range of only about four orders of magnitude between 100 solar masses. Sorry. Thank you. Good. Excellent. It's those inequalities in orders of magnitude. Everything's in the exponent. Pardon me? You're still awake. Yeah, better than me. Stars come in this range of only 10 to the, roughly of order 10 to the 3, and I want to talk about where this number comes from. After that, I'm going to quickly derive for you the luminosity of a star. And then the age of a star when its lifetime is set by the available, by burning of the available fuel. And in this case, I'm going to talk about just hydrogen burning. In this case, I'm going to talk about hydrogen. And then I'll close, in some sense. So this is going to be introductory. Some of you who've taken or taught stellar structure will probably see some of these arguments, but that's, I'm presuming, a minority of the audience. There's some who've done one or other, some who may have done both. And I'm going to discuss ages of stars in nearby, and by nearby I mean distances of order 100 parsecs, or 300 light years, what are called open clusters. And I'll show you some pictures of the nearby open cluster, the one I'm going to talk about the most, the Pleiades, which many of you have probably seen. I'll even have a diagram if you want to find out where it is on the sky. I can pass that around later. Okay, so that's going to be the schematic. And on this one, I'm going to compare the way in which we get the age from the conventional methods by thinking we understand the luminosity of a star. We think we know how much hydrogen it gets to burn. And so if we see a star of a given luminosity, we can say what the age is. That's your traditional method you'd see in the textbooks. And I'll compare that with the new method, which is due to what's called lithium depletion. And this is what I'll describe at the end of today's talk. Okay, but I've got a fair amount of ground to cover. You should interrupt me if you have any questions. But what I want to do first is give you some simple things and also put this in units of, say, the Planck constant, Planck mass, things like that. And I think I'll appeal to both the audiences here because I have even degenerate electrons later. So I think I just don't have magnetism. Okay, let me start with hydrostatic balance, because this really is what matters for stars. And that's, of course, just the statement that if I have, say, some pressure gradient somewhere in a star, that's just balanced by gravity. Okay, and I'm just writing this, say, in radial coordinates, where g is, of course, the local value of the gravitational field within the star, which just look like the mass enclosed over r squared. So if you solve for a stellar structure, of course, this is an equation. This is the momentum equation, presuming there's nothing changing. And this equation lets you do a lot. And let me first do the first thing, or pretty much the only thing I'm going to do with this,
which is use this to estimate the temperature at the center of a star, presuming it's held up by an ideal gas.
So if ideal gas pressure, okay, then the pressure is just given by, and I'm going to presume for now it's let's not worry about it. Let me just write it down. MP is the proton mass, rho is the density, mu is some mean molecular weight, it's just how many pressure-bearing particles there are. And if this was pure hydrogen ionized, I would just write, 2N proton KT. But I can use this, combined with this, to just estimate the temperature at the center of the star, and that's just simple. Obviously, that's just taking cheating with the derivatives, so I can just write this as, of course, P at the center over R is like rho times GM over R squared, but P at the center is just rho KT over mu NP. And what do I get? Well, you get something that looks hopefully somewhat familiar. I'm going to drop the mu's. You get that the temperature at the center of the star, the average kinetic energy, is comparable to the average gravitational energy. This you should know from the Virial theorem. Okay. For the sun, then, this tells you the temperature is around 10 to the 7. Tc is around 10 to the 7 K for the sun. Okay. So if I have a star, and I haven't told you anything about, of course, why is the mass the value it is, why is the radius the value it is. I haven't told you that yet. I'm just saying if I see a star of a given mass and radius, I know roughly what the temperature at the center is just from hydrostatic balance. Okay. All right, so what we have to do, though, is first figure out how big of a star I can construct or how small of a star in terms of mass I can construct. And that's the first thing I want to do. I want to describe for you briefly why this is the mass range observed, or the other way to say it is how to get a solar mass from just dimensional analysis, okay? Which you should, of course, always be suspicious of, so I will show you how to do it. And many of you might know Dirac spent years playing these games after he did more famous things, so you should be worried. Okay. So in some sense, I want to start by asking why, our mass is of order of the solar mass. Which, let me just remind you, let me give you the solar mass. I'll give it to you in grams. 2 by 10 to the 33 grams. And I'll give it to you in proton units in a moment. Okay.
NASA would give
it. Okay. On that note. All right, so let me start by telling you what the trouble is. Let me just say it. You're familiar with the Virial theorem, which I can derive from this equation. I'm not going to do it, but it tells you how to relate the kinetic energy to the gravitational energy. Okay, and then the total energy is obviously the sum. For non-relativistic particles, you know the answer that the total energy is always half of the gravitational. Okay. For relativistic particles, because the pressure exerted by relativistic particles is one-third their energy density, when you use the Virial theorem and calculate the total energy, you find the total energy is zero. Okay? So the problem is the following. If the particles, quote-unquote, supplying the pressure are relativistic, okay, then the total energy goes to zero. Okay. That's, of course, what sets what's called the Chandrasekhar mass. I'm going to discuss how that sets this value, okay, the high mass value. So the problem, why is that a problem? The problem is other physics can come in and make it much more complicated. Other things like just the ionization state or many different instabilities can ensue that make it difficult to have a model that will live for a long time when the particles that are exerting the pressure are all relativistic. So for high mass stars, what happens is that radiation pressure alone, so that's what I mean now by, that's why I put particles in quotes, is that radiation pressure predominates. Okay. So let me show you what happens and how out of this argument I want to have a star where the pressure, the radiation pressure, 1/3 A, see, let's just take the center value to the fourth, I want that quantity, okay, to be less than the pressure at the center of the star. Okay, I don't want the radiation pressure to be holding up the star, because when it does, I run into a conundrum. Okay. So what's the pressure at the center? Well, the pressure at the center I can again get just by writing this equation down, okay, estimating it. Of course, the pressure in the room is the column, the number of grams per square centimeter in the atmosphere, right? Which is, as you all know, about 1,000 grams per square centimeter times gravity, right? Times just the weight of that stuff sitting on your head. So we can write it in the same way for a star. It's gravity of the star, gm over r squared, times the number of grams per square centimeter, roughly. That's m over r squared. Okay, so that's the pressure at the center of a star, mass m and radius r. Okay, so we want this inequality. What does this inequality let us say? And that's what's interesting. Well, for the temperature, what I'll put in, of course, is the virial relation, presuming it's an ideal gas, right? I'm checking my approximation. Okay, and you can see what happens if I put in the T here. T goes like M over R. Okay? So the first thing you should see is that the radius cancels. The radius of the star, because this goes as 1 over R to the 4th, is 1 over R to the 4th here, the radius of the star cancels out. And so we select a mass. Okay, and that's what's interesting. Okay, so I'm going to skip the algebra and just show you the result. So this puts an inequality on the mass. What is that inequality? The radius cancels. That's why this is convenient. And what do we need to have? Okay. We basically have to have mass. And I'm skipping a lot of algebra. Okay. The mass in units of the proton mass, okay, needs to be less than something I'm going to call alpha g, which I'll define for you, to the 3/2. What's alpha g? It would be 1 at the Planck mass. So it's g m proton squared over h bar c. This is a very small number. It's a fine structure constant for gravity, which of course you all know has been 6 by 10 to the minus 39. You all know that, of course. It's like, you know, 1 over 137. Okay, so if you put in the Planck mass, it's 1. Okay. So literally, when you carry the algebra through, where's the h bar coming from? You might say, wait a minute, you've got some quantum mechanics. Absolutely. Quantum mechanics is right here in the radiation and the gas and the radiation constant. Okay. So up to here, there had been no quantum mechanics. Now there's some quantum mechanics. Comes in, and this is where I'm getting this h bar. Well, what is this number? Okay, I could write this differently if I wanted to, as m is less than the proton mass, the Planck mass over the proton mass cubed, just a rewrite, okay? But this is now, you know, in units, so the Planck mass is in GeV, 10 to the 19, so this is 10 to the 19, right, cubed, so this is 10 to the 57, okay? Well, 10 to the 57 proton masses is about the mass of the sun. Okay. So the first point I want to make, so you shouldn't believe there's a prefactor here, right? So when you do this carefully, construct your star, the number's like 50 or 100. Okay. So the first thing to say is that we're seeing, first off, the first bit of quantum mechanics coming in that tells us if we try to construct a star in hydrostatic balance, it's 1,000 or 10,000 solar masses. The difficulty one runs into is that the total energy is so close to zero that a lot of intervening physics can unbind it or make it collapse either way. Okay? And there was, of course, a lot of work done on these stars, and people still struggle over what to do with them. But the thing I wanted to bring up for this audience is that there is a characteristic number of order of solar mass. It's just this alpha G. Yeah.
It would be relativistic. Particle size, that's true, but it doesn't mean that it could not be an object of the next scale.
No, you can construct such an object. You can make it in hydrostatic balance if you allow no physics other than just ideal gas, non-interacting, fully ionized plus radiation. It's a happy star. Okay. The problem is you get it, there's a large number of instabilities the minute you relax any of those assumptions. For example, right, the energy release from recombining hydrogen can potentially unbind the star. That's one case. So that ends up generating, say, pulsational instabilities. So, and the most massive star we've seen is about 70.
Yeah, but then the theory that there is no star in this relativistic range, couldn't be an object in this relativistic range, or it is a gas?
No, I would say it's... No, this is not a proof, if that's what you're asking. This by no means is a proof. Okay. What you have to do is actually construct the object on the computer and search for all types of instabilities, radial instabilities, non-radial instabilities. And when that is carried out and done, what people find is that, you know, 100 or 200 solar mass star has a very difficult time having a normal life like the Sun. Okay.
Right? Yeah. Exactly the same calculation of degenerate electrons we generate. The same answer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So how does it could be?
Oh. Mm-hmm. So if you carry this out for. Sure. Absolutely. That's how you get the Chandrasekhar mass. This is the same argument for the Chandrasekhar mass, except you have to go back and put in the proper. I mean, there's factors of unity everywhere floating around in this argument, and there are factors of unity different between radiation holding up a star with baryons versus an electron, you know, electrons holding up a star with baryons, in terms of just how the scalings go. Not the scalings, but sorry, the prefactors, the dimensionless prefactors. So for a star, you get 100. For the Chandrasekhar mass, you get, you know, if it's 2 electrons per baryon, you get 1.4. But, you know, it's the same physics coming in. Yeah, the dimensions are the same, absolutely. Pardon me? It's the protons that give the star the mass. That's right. Okay. All right, so that's the first piece of physics that comes in. What's the second piece of physics? The second piece of physics that comes in is that, so this sets the high mass end, and I can get a solar mass on the back of an envelope, okay, which is just this quantity. What comes in at much lower masses? Well, that one is unfortunately not as clean, but let me explain it anyway. What comes in at lower masses is degeneracy of the electrons. So what we have to do is, I just erased it, but the virial theorem, let me just remind you again, tells us that T is, of course, proportional to M over R. Okay? But I can construct a star held up by purely degenerate electrons at T equals zero. Okay? I can always do that. And so, of course, this breaks down. When does this break down? It breaks down when the ideal gas law starts to deviate due to degeneracy. Okay? And the difficulty then is that as the star gets smaller, it need not be the case that the temperature rises. Okay, so in a typical star that's held by an ideal gas, this tells you as it contracts, the temperature is rising, and eventually you should be able to fuse some element. Okay, and it's, of course, reaching a temperature high enough to start fusion that allows the thing to live at some fixed radius for a long time. But if I become degenerate before I reach some characteristic temperature, then as the star contracts, the temperature need not continue to rise. Okay, and the temperature becomes decoupled. So let me do that one for you, because that's a different argument. And that is, I want to check degeneracy. So let's check electron degeneracy. Well, I want to have, that's right, this is just the de Broglie wavelength. All right, I want this to be less than the mean spacing of the electrons. All right, so I want to be non-degenerate. I want the wave functions to be much smaller than the mean spacing. So we can just put it in that then. That's then, of course, this H bar over MeV electron thermal less than Ne to the minus 1/3. Okay? Okay, so we would just put in then, of course, what the thermal speed is in terms of the temperature, the density is in terms of the mass and the radius, and chug it through the algebra. What do you get? Okay, so this you're going to have to trust the intervening six steps of just algebra. What does it tell you? It tells you that the mass, again, in units of the proton mass, okay, have to be bigger than 1 over alpha g, it comes back again, our friend, alpha g to the 3/2. Okay, that pops back again. Of course, there's an h-bar right there staring at you. And then the way I've chosen to write it is I have to keep the temperature in, okay, because I have to actually ask, at what temperature do I check this inequality? Okay? So again, what we find is that this is the same inequality, so this is non-degenerate. I'm giving you the inequality to be non-degenerate. Okay? So the way to say it is if I want to have a star reach some temperature while it's non-degenerate, it has to exceed some mass. Okay?
Well,
yep.
That's a little counterintuitive, right? You're saying that normally I think if I sort of add mass, I'm making things more dense and more likely to become degenerate. And you're saying that.
But we're always following, you know, we're always following along for a star that's under the virial theorem constraint. Okay? So everything's counterintuitive in the sense that as the star shrinks. I don't know it's counterintuitive because I've done it so much it seems natural to me. So, you know, the star shrinks, it's becoming more bound, right? The average kinetic energy is going up. I don't know, maybe that's counterintuitive. So in this argument, sorry, so maybe I should have put in the steps. So for Ne, I've just gotten rid of the radius is all I've done. Okay, so Ne is like M over R cubed, right? Okay, I put that in, and everywhere for the radius, I put in temperature instead. So that's why I have mass and temperature rather than mass and radius. Okay. Okay. It's hard to know how to. Okay. Well, this is an important relation because this actually tells you why massive stars get to burn things differently. But let me first tell you what limit this sets. To burn hydrogen. At a rate to match.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Sort of confused about.
Sure.
And you should add the dimension of 1 over length cubed, right?
So.
Because on the left you have length. Mm-hmm. So there's no mass there. It's just the number density.
Right. That's right. Sorry.
There's no mass there.
Sorry. Oh. There's a proton mass. Sorry. Thanks. This is the number. Yeah. Okay. Was that your? That was okay. Okay. So to burn hydrogen at a rate to match the luminosity, which I haven't told you yet what it is, we roughly need the temperature to be about 2 to 3 × 10⁶ Kelvin. Okay, for a low mass star, that's what you find. Okay. Well, you can plug that in here. Okay. Right, so this is 10⁷ is 1 kilovolt. Okay, so this is about 200 electron volts over 500 kilovolts. Okay, so this gives you a number much smaller than a solar mass. All right, much smaller than a solar mass. What's the real number when you do the full blown shtick? Okay, it's about 0.08 solar masses. To be a. You don't. To match the. You don't. Low mass stars are very, very, very faint relative to the sun.
So that's just what we cannot see, you mean?
No. If I want to construct a star, where the hydrogen burning rate matches the luminosity leaving the star.
Uh-huh.
Okay, that's what I mean by you get to live for a while on your fuel. Okay, when you calculate that for low mass stars, the temperature is around 2 to 3 by 10 to the 6. I just want to tell you that the temperature is much less than mc squared.
Right.
That's
so
all I want you to get from this argument. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So now both. So as of 2 years ago, it was pure theory. In the last 2 years, they've actually now really found these objects. Objects less massive than this are what are called brown dwarfs. They've now really been discovered and studied in the last 2 years. So now actually there's a real comparison between theory and observation.
When you say to match the luminosity, what's the input for?
Sure. Actually, I'll get to that in a minute. So I got a little bit ahead of myself in the mass range. So I'll do more, and then you can ask again if I haven't answered you. The other thing that's important to point out, though, is that if I want to burn heavier elements, let's say I want to burn helium to carbon or carbon, etc., I always have to go to higher temperatures to do that. Okay, just from the Coulomb barrier, basically. Okay, and you can see then that what that says is that this sets a hierarchy of masses that's allowed to burn those elements. Okay, so 0.08 is to be a star and burn hydrogen, I will just tell you the numbers. It's about 2.5 solar masses, blah, 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 to be a star and burn helium. That requires, by the way, a temperature of about 2 by 10 to the 8 Kelvin, okay, roughly. And it's roughly 6 to 8, people still debate, solar masses to burn carbon and or oxygen. Okay, so this sets the hierarchy, basically, of which stars get to burn. So more massive stars get to burn heavy elements, and low-mass stars peter out.
But if the mass is lower than that, then it's not burning any hydrogen, right?
That's right.
It still would exist, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, and I'll show you. I'll talk about those types of stars in a minute. Jupiter is an example of an extremely low mass case where this number is 10 to the minus 3 solar masses. Okay, Jupiter, we think, has no fusion going on, and there's about a paper every 3 years claiming otherwise. And it's living a bit on the gravitational energy release. It's still doing a bit of contraction. Okay, but the power source, if any, is just the gravitational energy release. And it's very degenerate. Okay, at the center. It's hydrogen at a density of 3 grams per cubic center. At the center.
But one often reads the statement that Jupiter is on the edge of burning.
Jupiter's far, far away. So this is 0.1 roughly, uh-huh. And Jupiter is 10 to the minus 3. So Jupiter is really quite far from burning hydrogen.
Okay, and the core is all hydrogen.
The core, well, we don't know. We think the core is mostly hydrogen and helium. The very, very center of the core might have a sediment, might have a little iron core, but that would be a very small fraction of the mass. But that's just belief rather than. Jim, did you have?
How old would that then be affected if the stars weren't confined to the brains?
Well, it was for that reason.
Oh.
Okay. I was taking that seriously. I mean, you're not the first to ask such a question, okay? Yeah, Lisa?
What is that temperature mean?
Sorry. This one?
Yeah.
This temperature is pretty much at the center. I'm just asking the center temperature needs to exceed 2 or 3 million Kelvin. And I'll show you on a plot when I show view graphs that somewhere you can really see what that number looks like. It depends on the mass. Okay. All right, great. So what I've done, hopefully, is given you a sense of where the solar mass thing comes from. And now when your children ask you, you can just tell them it's the 3/2 root of the gravitational fine structure constant. That'll work like a charm. What I haven't told you is why they shine at the rate they do. Okay? Okay, what sets the luminosity? Sorry, this is luminosity. Okay, so far you should think of this star as it has a temperature at the center of order, the virial temperature, it has a given mass, and I haven't yet set the radius. I haven't done any physics that tells you what radius it settles in at. But first thing I want to set is the luminosity. And I want to do this just for one case, which is simple, which is four stars more massive than the Sun. Okay, I'm just going to tell you that the heat transport is just mediated by Thomson scattering of the photons. Thomson scattering of photons. So, namely, the heat transport is set from the gradient. There's a whopping gradient in the energy density of radiation from the center to the surface. Okay? Because it's this value, say for the Sun, it's 10 to the 7 at the center. At the surface, it's much, much colder. And of course, the flux is just set by the rate at which heat can diffuse down that gradient. Okay? Normal conduction won't do it. I'll just tell you that. You have to take it on face value. So let's look at radiative transport. Well, again, I can just write down, in some sense, a Fick's law. This is the flux. All right, what is that? The flux is just 1/3 times the speed the particles move at. These are photons, so that's C. Their mean free path, lambda, okay, times the density, I'm sorry, the gradient of the energy density, which is AT to the fourth. Okay? Well, I know what lambda is. That's just 1 over the local electron density times the Thomson cross-section. And I know what this gradient is. This is obviously 1 over the radius divided by the central temperature, multiplied by the central temperature to the fourth, right? Be bold. Okay, this is just m over r to the fourth. And the luminosity, so L, is, of course, then something like 4 pi r squared times the flux. Okay? Well, let me just show you one thing about this, because it's very convenient and it's very important, is that this mass, or do it over here, is independent of the radius of the star. And again, that's a funny result. It just results from doing this dimensional analysis. Let me do it. So let me just write down this luminosity, and I'll just put in the scaling. So there's an r squared times the flux. Okay, the flux has a 1 over density here, but the density is, of course, the mass divided by the radius cubed. Okay, so I'm getting rid of my units. I'm just putting in the scalings. This is 1 over r. ddr is 1 over r. And t to the fourth is m over r to the fourth. So hopefully if I did things right, the radius cancels. And it does. Then you find that L is proportional to m cubed. Okay? So the first thing, and this is true, I mean, you can there's evidence for this. The first thing you can say is that for stars more massive than the Sun, as long as the heat transport is as I said, the luminosity is basically independent of the radius. Okay. So just so you have something to carry around with you, I will put all the constants in and baseline it for the Sun. So L is, of course, the luminosity of the Sun, m over m Sun cubed. Okay. Just save you all the steps. All right. Okay. So that's what sets the luminosity, is just this heat transport. And for lower mass stars, it's a different physics that sets this mean free path. It's actually inverse Bremsstrahlung. And for extremely low mass stars, it's completely different. Okay, it's convective motion. But let me focus on this for a moment. So what sets the luminosity then is the mass. Okay? All right. So I want to have you get the chain of events right. Well, first off, what is that comparable to? Let me give you a number. So this is, what's the number, first off, sorry. What is L sun? L sun is 4 times 10 to the 33 ergs per second. I don't even know the NASA unit for luminosity. Pounds per, I don't know. Okay. I can give you Or, in some sense, actually, if you want to get a sense of how bright this is, so this wouldn't help you, but let me just give it to you anyway. It's equivalent to fusing the Earth's atmosphere in 12 days. Okay? So if you decided the thing to do was to fuse the Earth's atmosphere, if you did it in 12 days, you'd be as bright as the sun. Okay?
What? Okay,
so you know joules. So I thought you might want it in some h bar equals c equals one equals the. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
I think the last thing is put up in watts.
Pardon me?
I think nothing is in watts.
Watts. I'm not going to give it to you in watts. You can do it yourself. Yeah.
Give it in grams.
Grams. Okay. So so you can see the interesting thing for these stars is, again, what sets the luminosity is their mass, not their radius. Okay. Let me just tell you then, I'm not going to derive it because it's not time. What fixes the radius of these stars? Well, what fixes the radius of a star is the requirement that the nuclear burning, that the temperature at the center has reached a temperature adequate so that the integral of all the nuclear burning matches this luminosity. Okay? So I'll just tell you that in words, is what fixes the radius is the balance between nuclear energy release and this luminosity. Okay, so that's what fixes the radius of the star. That's what's called the main sequence, the line of stars in what's called a Hertzsprung-Russell diagram that tells you where these stars are in terms of their effective temperature. So, of course, if I fix the L and R, now I know the surface temperature. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, as you can tell, a lot of assumptions, right? I'm just doing this dimensional analysis. So, when you do it in detail, when you do a detailed stellar structure model, you solve for everything as a function of radius. So you do the full solution. So you
have a proper equation of state.
Oh yeah. So you have to put in all the microphysics. That's why I don't want to do it for you. But you have to you put in the right equation of state, you put in the best you know of the conductivities, or what are called the opacities, you put in the best you know of the nuclear physics, and you solve it, the full problem. The main sequence is this sort of eigenvalue when the luminosity matches the nuclear luminosity. Okay, so that you just write down all the differential equations and solve them, okay? Which today is not a problem. Okay, how long does a star live? Well, now we're getting to what I want to talk about. Well, it lives. So we have roughly this luminosity. So there are stars that we refer to as main sequence. What are those? These are, again, stars burning hydrogen. Hydrogen, fusing it into helium. At a rate to match the luminosity. And absolutely, the rate at which this occurs in different stars, sometimes it's very centrally concentrated. Some stars have appreciable burning at the half radius point. So it really depends on the nature of the nuclear reactions. For the sun, which is mostly doing it via the first step is a PP fusion, a straight fusion reaction of the protons, the energy source is relatively well distributed. Okay, but it really does depend. Okay, so how long can it live then? Okay, well, it can live basically, if I want to write down something simple, as long as it just lives on the fuel. So a massive star burns out its fuel much faster just because it's brighter. Okay. So let's call something F, being the fraction of fuel I get to burn. Okay, M is the mass of the star, and I'm going to release roughly 5 MeV per nucleon. And I put in 5 here rather than 7 because the starting abundance is that hydrogen's, it's not 100% hydrogen, there's already helium around. Okay? So I've adjusted this for the fraction of hydrogen to helium. So it's that divided by L. Okay? What is that? That's about 7.6 gigayears if I get to burn let's say, 10% of my fuel, and I'm roughly a solar mass. Okay? So that's the point I want to make, is that stars, and you can see a massive star, of course, will burn out in a very short time. Okay? 10 solar mass star will do it in 100 million years. Okay? And of course, we live, our sun is about 5.5 billion years old. It's known that accurately from different methods. Okay, so as you can imagine, the parameter that's hard to get or hard to know is this F. To get that F, you have to solve for the evolution of the structure as a function of time as you're changing the abundances everywhere. For the sun, this is not a hard problem, because in the sun, in the interior, there's no convective motion. It's stably stratified. There's no mixing, as far as we know, anywhere in the deep interior. So you can probably trust someone when they calculate for you how the abundances are changing. Okay?
How would you know for
Right now, the best constraints on... Well, there's two things. There's two ways you probe the interior. There's obviously the solar neutrinos. Okay? Okay? What's more recent, and which there's a lot more data on, are the helioseismology, basically observations of modes that penetrate in. Okay? And some of those modes go deep enough that you actually get constraints on the sound speed as a function of depth. And it's comparison, which then is the temperature. Okay? So you can compare then those runs to what it would be if it were convectively unstable. You can ask, is that run of temperature convectively stable? And the answer is yes. Okay, so if I just say, from purely observations, not using any theory, you can get the run of temperature, and then you can ask, is that stable, the convection? In the sense of, if it's so hot at the bottom, of course, then it might be convectively unstable. And the answer right now is yes, it is stable. So that's, in some sense, pretty much theory independent. Okay, so if you really wanted to be a skeptic...
Well, sometimes you hear the statement that we know much more about the center of the sun than the center of the Earth. That's true, right? Is that true?
Depends on what question you're asking.
Composition.
I mean, the center of the Earth. I mean, well, I can't speak to our knowledge about the center of the Earth. So.
If I put in n.1 solar mass.
Oh, sorry. Okay, sorry. Okay, this relation is not valid at 0.1 solar masses. Okay, so do not use these formula willy-nilly. Okay, low mass stars, this relation goes like almost m to the 6. It's extreme. They're extremely faint. Low mass stars last much, much longer than the age of the universe. I don't know if that's what you're getting at, but okay. Yeah, absolutely. So there have been papers on what happens to the universe when it's 1,000 giga-years old. Okay. And well, yeah, then have to calculate stellar structure for lower mass stars than the sun. Okay, and that's mostly of academic interest. But okay, all right. So, how do you find the age of a star? So now I've told you everything you need to know about stellar structure and evolution. Now let's use it. How do you get the age of a star? Well, let me talk briefly about things that are called open clusters in our galaxy. Okay? These are regions where, as far as we can tell, stars were born nearly at the same time. So they all had the same birthday. Okay? And an example, this is upside down, but you won't know. An example is the Pleiades. Okay, which is this picture. This is the globular cluster. This is not what I'm going to talk about. This is the Pleiades, and you can see it's called an open cluster because it's not this. Okay, and I'll pass this around. There's two of these. What I want to talk about today is finding the age of that cluster, how you find the age of that cluster. So here's another picture of it here. And this is a cluster that's about 100 parsecs away, and I've got a sky map here for all those of you who want to go look at it tonight, if the weather cooperates. What do we know about open clusters? So let me talk about one, the Pleiades, and I always misspell it. So you just live with it, Pleiades. It's about 130 parsecs away, and the traditional age in the textbooks, age in the books is 75 million years. Okay?
For each star.
Okay, so let me show you. How do you do this? Well, the first thing to notice is that for about a 10 solar mass star, it's about 75 mega years, right? Okay? So what do? How do you get the age? Well, you go and you observe it, cluster, and you make a plot, which all physicists hate, because it's plotted backwards. You plot luminosity versus effective temperature, but you have the effective temperature increase to the left. This is just to keep everybody out of the field. Alright. Hey, this is a log. Imagine this being a log plot. So the line of constant radius ends up running pretty much like this. I'm just going to draw this schematically, okay? So the massive stars are up here. This is luminosity does increase in this direction at least. So the massive stars are up here, and let's just draw a line, which is, let's say, the main sequence. So I'm just going to draw a line, okay, and call this the main sequence. Okay, and let's just put the sun somewhere here, say. Here's the sun, so here's L sun. So massive stars are up here, okay? So if you could look at the and when this cluster forms, it forms a spectrum of stars. There's very few massive stars, a lot of low-mass stars, okay? And what you see then is that there are a lot of stars sitting on this main sequence. Star, 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 star. But eventually you stop seeing them. They run out. Okay, you don't see anymore. Okay, and it's not just the fact that they're rare. It's not just you're running out. You can look at another cluster that's younger and it keeps going up. And what you're seeing is the fact that because it has a finite age, these stars have finished. They're hydrogen burning. Okay. So the game we play is you do your best at getting the distance. Okay. You therefore can measure the luminosity, and then you go up and you look in the book of the stellar models that tells you how old, so you have a luminosity and therefore in some sense you have the mass of the star. You then go look in your book and the stellar theorists tell you, well, we know of course that F is some number, and so the age of the cluster is some number. Okay, that's the game. Okay, so this is always, this is the traditional method.
How do you know the distance?
Well, now we know it from Hipparchos, which measured the parallax. Okay, except these are wrong. So you might say, well, if it's the best measurement, how do we know it's wrong? It's wrong because you put all the open clusters on the same diagram, and they're all parallel to each other but not lining up. So somebody's wrong. So there was previous measurements. I'm actually using the old measurements still. For this cluster, this is not a moving. So actually, there's different methods, and I'm not sure which one this uses. So the Hipparchos number is 100. So we're talking, you know, we're not talking factors of 2 here. Okay, so sort of
20%. What do you mean Hipparchos is wrong? I mean, it's just geometry.
This is ESA. This is ESA. This is
the taxpayers' money.
But the European taxpayers in this case,
yeah.
Which might bother you more than me. It's unclear. Apparently, strips on the sky are correlated. And so the way in which they've done their scanning, it appears to be the case that in certain strips, the distances are different than in other strips. I mean, there's an offset. But the theorists are telling the observers this is what's happening. So it's not been sorted out. Doesn't matter for this. So this traditional upper main sequence, okay? So from the observations, you need F to get the age, this fudge factor F. Okay? That should be clear. Right?
How does the so-called metals affect?
No. I mean the sum of all the metals. This is a young cluster, so the metallicity here is probably about 2 times the solar metallicity. So by mass fraction, it's not more than 2%. So metals to astrophysicists is everything heavier than helium. Should make that clear. Okay. So, but I mean, yeah. So it's 2% by mass of everything heavier than helium. Okay. All right. Okay, so the problem is you need F. Okay? Why is that hard? That's hard. So when you do this, you get this number of 75 million years. But what F is used? Well, I need to talk briefly about, and sorry, this mass of these stars is about, mass is about, you know, 6, because this formula is not quite right. It's about 6 solar masses today at the turnoff. So this is called the main sequence turnoff here. Okay. And I'm not going to talk about where these stars go. It's a whole different lecture. But they go elsewhere. All right. What's the problem with these stars? The problem with these stars is that their structure, so for stars more than about 2 solar masses, if I drew a picture of the structure of the star, the problem is the following. The burning for these is via what's called the CNO cycle. It's using carbon, nitrogen, oxygen as a catalyst for hydrogen burning. And that ends up being very temperature sensitive, those reactions, because you have to have a Coulomb barrier for the proton to capture onto a heavy element like carbon or nitrogen. That means the energy generation is very centrally concentrated. It's so centrally concentrated that the only way the star can get the heat out is to have convective motions. Okay? So when you construct on your computer one of these stars, what you find is that there's a convective core. And out here, it's stable. So out here, there's basically no convection going on. This is just radiative diffusion. Okay. So this is a very different problem now, because the burning, I'm constantly mixing in elements from out here to the interior. Okay. And you then have to decide where to put this boundary. Okay. And for that reason, we've always been suspicious. I mean, you do the best you can in a 1D model. But what people have always been suspicious of this fudge factor of this thing F. Okay? And the biggest suspicion is that first off, the models are all 1D, but let's not even worry about that. The standard problem is that the presumption is a convective cell, when it hits this boundary, stops. Okay? And there's nothing, and the mystery is, But that can't be right. There's kinetic energy in that motion. It should penetrate up into this region, which is stably stratified. So it's like a plume coming up into a region that's stably, so it gets pushed back down. So it goes up, pops up into a region where the restoring force is to push it down, but it would go out some distance. If it goes out some distance and brings in this stuff out here is hydrogen rich and brings it in, you basically get to increase your F. Okay. So the thoughts everybody had was that the F that had been calculated was a minimum F. But there was no way to confirm it. So what I want to talk about in the brief 5 minutes I have left is the resolution of this puzzle, which is by finding the age of stars in these clusters in a completely different method. So we have this baseline. We think the age of the Pleiades is 75 million years, but is there another way to get the age? Well, the answer is yes. There is one other way to get the age, and it's now proving to be quite accurate. And what is it? Well, if I draw again this main sequence, and I'm going to have it bend a little bit. Again, this is L. This is T effective. I'm just going to put the sun here. These stars have left the main sequence, so somewhere up here it cuts off. Let's say that's the most massive star you can find in the cluster. What's happening at the low end? Well, at the low mass end, in this age of this cluster, this 75 million years, 100 million years, the low mass objects have not even reached the main sequence. So these stars are all born, we're presuming, within about a 1 or 5 million year period. The massive stars, because they're so luminous, evolve faster. They burn up every available energy, gravitational energy, nuclear energy, on a much faster time scale. The low mass stars, being very faint, don't have to evolve as fast. Okay? And what happens is the low mass stars are just now starting to even ignite hydrogen burning, even to start it, much less to finish it. Okay? So they're still reaching the main sequence. Okay? Well, how do they reach the main sequence? They reach the main sequence almost on a constant effective temperature trajectory. And you have to take that for now. You have to trust me on that one. Okay, there's a very strong thermostat in the atmospheric opacity that fixes this temperature. And what happens is different mass stars come down different trajectories. And they basically evolve at constant temperature. Okay? But what are they living on? They're luminous, right? They're powering, they're sending out radiation. What energy source are they tapping? Well, they're tapping the gravitational contraction, right? The continuous gravitational contraction of the matter. Okay? So they live then. So the case for these is very simple. This is just a very simple calculation. I just say the luminosity sets the rate at which the rate at which the radius must contract, just from saying that L, of course, 4 pi T effective to the 4th R squared is just d dt of the total energy, plus or minus. Okay? But the total energy I know for this object, it ends up, I can calculate the interior structure of this, and I know what it is. It's ends up being 3/7 gm squared over r. Okay, so you can integrate this at constant t effective to get the radius as a function of time. Okay, so the star just comes down, and the radius contracts as a function of time. Well, what happens? These stars are so opaque that the only way they transport the heat is via convection. So there's convective motions from the interior all the way to the photosphere, okay, in these stars. That's, of course, why I was able to get such a simple formula. That means actually the entropy is flat. It's constant entropy all the way through the interior to the surface. Okay. What does that mean? Yeah. Jupiter's like this. Except for some recent wrinkles, but yeah. This is basically Jupiter. Okay? Jupiter's harder than this problem. This is colder. Jupiter's, you know, way down here. Okay. So what happens? Well, it just contracts according to the evolution of this formula until eventually again the temperature gets hot enough to burn the hydrogen. But one thing happens before, and that is you get to burn lithium. Okay, so let's just go through the periodic table. I, of course, want to burn hydrogen. That's the thing to burn. But if I want to burn hydrogen, I've got to make a neutron, right, to burn hydrogen. If I want to do anything. Okay, I want to make a neutron and then make deuterium and then I'm off and running. Okay, to do that, of course, I need a weak interaction. And the reason then that you can burn other elements before you burn the hydrogen to make helium is you just have to find a reaction. This is a purely strong reaction. Okay? The first reaction that goes in a star is burning the deuterium. Okay? So there is some deuterium in the interstellar medium. It's made in the Big Bang. It loves to burn. And it goes to helium-3 plus a photon, if I'm counting right. Yeah. Okay? That happens fast. And it makes the star live for a little while on deuterium. So there's a little deuterium main sequence, okay, which observers have pretty well mapped out now in the last 2 years. That happens way up here. Very low temperature. There's a little main sequence kind of sitting up here. Stars live. They sort of contract a little bit more slowly for a while because they don't have to eat up gravitational energy. Okay. So is it okay. What's the next one? Well, the next one of relevance I want to talk about is lithium-7. This goes to 2 alpha particles. Again, a purely strong reaction. There's also the same for lithium-6, except the endpoints are different. And you can go through beryllium, boron, et cetera, et cetera. But these things all end up burning before hydrogen. Okay, so let me show you that. Let me show you what these look like on a temperature plot. And you can see why, hopefully, in that I'm not paying the cost of weak interaction. So though the Coulomb barrier for proton and proton is really small, right? If I want to have a PP at the same time, one of those protons turns to neutron, I have to pay the weak interaction, right? Price in the cross section. That's whopping, okay? And so for that reason, these things go first, even though the Coulomb barriers are higher. They're purely strong reactions. So here's a plot from one of the papers. And what is this? This is showing the mass of the star on the x-axis and the central temperature on the y-axis. And let me start by showing you what we call the zero-age main sequence. Okay? So these green points are the place where the nuclear energy would be the total energy, the nuclear energy release, the luminosity, would be the luminosity of the star. So it would be this line. Okay? What happens to the trajectory? I don't have a trajectory on here. A 0.1 solar mass star, or let's say a 0.2 solar mass star, evolves in this way. It's a function of time. It's just moving up in central temperature because the radius is getting smaller. T goes like 1 over R. It's rising. This line is where the thermonuclear destruction of, say, lithium-6 is comparable to the contraction time. Okay? So the lithium-6 gets burned first. The next element that gets burned is lithium-7. And what I'm showing is the half depletion and the 1/100th depletion. It's very fast, and that's critical. It's very fast because this Coulomb barrier is huge. So it's a very temperature-sensitive reaction. Here's beryllium-9, doesn't matter. But what you can see is that I burn the lithium at a temperature of, say, 3 or 3 by 10 to the 6, long before I get to the main sequence. Long before. Okay? That means as these stars are falling down this trajectory, there's a place at which the lithium goes away. Okay? And it ends up, you can observe the lithium line. And so what's been found in the last 2 years is that the observers have been working very hard to identify what they call this lithium depletion boundary. Map it out. You see that some high-mass star has crossed it and ends up the high-mass stars cross first. So if these are at the same time, I'll just draw this for you, the boundary would say look like, sort of looks like this, namely, this guy has burned it and this guy hasn't. So this is, let's say, 0.1, and let's say this is 0.09. The high-mass star burns it first, and this one they'll see no lithium, and the next star over, it'll have the normal abundance. Okay? You can see what that tells you. It tells you that this temperature's crossed this boundary. Okay? So the lithium goes away, and it goes away very rapidly, right when you cross that boundary. Okay? And it's at a very short time scale. So typically they either see a star with its full value or with nothing. Okay, because you have to be really lucky to catch it in this little interval. Alright. Now the beauty is that you can calculate these things completely analytically, and the only microphysics you need to know is the thermonuclear reaction rate, and this temperature at which you deplete goes as about the 1/120th power of that. So that's because the temperature is so sensitive. Okay, so what we found, and so people had appreciated this as a way in which you could, I'll get to how you get the age in a moment, to see the lithium depletion. What hadn't been appreciated, and what is the work that I had done with a number of graduate students, Ed Brown, Chris Massner, and Gregory Shemirsky, was to actually show that this was so accurate, or so independent of the microphysics, that you really should believe it. Okay, and that was, in some sense, the thing we contributed to this effort, was showing that it's actually extremely robust to the microphysics. So how do you play the game? Well, let me just show you an example. This is a bit busy. If the lithium is gone, so the amazing thing is we have an assumption, which is the star is fully mixed. Okay? That's an assumption. And so far there's been nothing to say it's not true, but it's a pretty dramatic assumption. If lithium's gone, then the central temperature has exceeded some number. Okay? So this is how the game is playing. Therefore, the mass over the radius has exceeded some number. But we know the radius because we know the luminosity of the star, we know the distance, we know the effective temperature. So the radius is known. Okay? That says the mass of that star has got to be bigger than some value. Okay? The time, the age of that star to contract to a given radius is just given by the gravitational energy, it's living on its gravity, divided by the luminosity. So the contraction time, then, as you can see, if we know R, we know M is bigger than something, it's bigger than some number. So you get an inequality. So if you see a star with no lithium, you say the age of that star is bigger than some number. Now imagine you see another star where you see the lithium. Everything inverts. You get an upper and a lower bound. Here's an example of the time, or the age, and the mass of the star. And what's plotted are the allowed regions. Here's a star which has burned its lithium, so it can be older than this value, it could be anywhere up here, and we get a constraint on its mass. This error bar here is this with the luminosity. Uncertainties in the luminosity move you around. This is the lithium is burned. So to that side, there's another star which has lithium, and you get the inverted relation. And this was stuff actually this is from an original paper, and I'll show you the current numbers in a moment, but it tells you the ages between 100 and, you know, 200. Not so good. Okay, but the minimum age was 100, already at odds with the 75 I quoted. Okay.
You don't have to know anything about the abundance of lithium in the original
material? No, the lithium, what you see in the star, there are a whole bunch of stars above and below the boundary. And you see basically a step jump in the lithium abundance. So it's for that reason that you needn't worry too much about if there was a bit about the absolute value of the abundance.
Yeah, but still it would be nice to see if it's in correspondence with, I don't know, models which predicts abundance.
The abundance you see in the young stars that haven't burned it is the abundance in the interstellar medium. It looks like the primordial abundance. Okay. So the value is right when you can do it. Okay. The problem is getting the abundance from the spectra is tricky. Okay. All right, so let me just wrap up by showing you the current state of this game. So I think we need lights again. I'll let you all go. So this has now been done by observers in three different clusters. I'll just write the results over here. And so the field has actually become much sort of more... This is the name of the cluster, the traditional age, the textbook age you'll find in your books, and the age from lithium. Okay, so there's the Pleiades. The traditional age is about 70. These are always in megayears. And the age from lithium today, from the observers, is that. Okay. This cluster, I'm just going to show you a whole bunch. Alpha Persei. The textbook age is 50. This is 90, plus or minus 10. And this will mean nothing. IC2391, 35 is now 53, plus or minus 5.
These are supposed to report at the same time, all the same age.
Sorry, these are separate clusters. Right. They all have their own different birthdays.
Mm-hmm. And the birthdays are the same to within what?
One thinks from studying young, from areas where there's current star formation, that the gap in the age is probably no more than 5 or 10. I mean, 10 would be extreme. Five million years is about the current number. So you can't, there's nothing observed with this big of an age range where you see active star formation going on and stars leaving the main sequence at the same time. So the thought is you can't solve this just by having things born on different dates.
But this number 70, for example, is based on this effect, right?
Right, exactly.
It's a theoretical one.
That's right.
Systematically underestimated.
Yeah. So these are all the ones with the F being the. Or that's right. The no mixing. So this, the ratios of these, in some sense, is telling what the F needs to be. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's about 1.8. You can see these two. Actually, I put that here because I hadn't. If you write the ratio, it's 1.8, 1.8, 1.5. Okay, and these stars, the stars that are leaving the main sequence, and these aren't that different in mass. Okay, so it tells you that that you have to burn sort of twice the amount of fuel, well, 80% more than you thought. Okay, and that has a lot of repercussions because that says that those objects, when they leave the main sequence, have a bigger helium core by a factor of 2. Okay, and that ends up being very important for things like Cepheids, which are a very popular distance indicator. Because the ambiguity in a star is, you know the total mass, you can sometimes get that, but you can't tell if it's evolved, what's the fraction of helium to hydrogen, if you have a core.
Say, when you put this plot for the sequence, there is more deviation, you said some F, okay,
yeah.
Whatever it is, and all the those stars and sequence on the line, or they are deviations?
Just on this curve.
Yeah.
Sorry.
What does vector show this?
This is well known. This is the what's called the zero age main sequence. As you draw the trajectory of the evolution, what are called isochrones. What's the if you look at a given age, what's it look like? The isochrones sort of look like this. Okay. So they evolve while they're still burning hydrogen. They actually move a bit to the right.
Your stars are
tipping on
the curve accurately enough.
Sorry. Your question's a good one. So let me write it this way. If F were 0.1,
yeah.
let's call this line the place where you leave the main sequence.
Okay.
So let me draw another line.
Yeah.
This is called terminal age main sequence. Okay, you're done burning. This is the place you live when you're done, if F is 0.1. Mm-hmm. If F is 0.2, this line's different. It's sitting over here.
But you can measure it. Right?
And that's right. And there were definitely, I didn't want to get into it. You're absolutely asking the right question. There were already stars that were on the wrong side of this curve, and we're already telling people that there had to be some amount of this overshoot. So absolutely. So let me not give you the impression that it's only from this that we know there has to be this what's called overshoot. There were definitely indications from these, which are were difficult to calibrate. But you're absolutely right. So this, in some sense, the ideal world would be you'd use this as the age. You'd say, we now know it, and go back and play the game the other way.
But you also need to know the distance.
Yeah, for this issue, the distance is known to about 15% at worst.
Well,
so it's not so that doesn't change the luminosities that much. That's only a 30% correction.
I mean, do they have to be different renormalization of the F? Or could you live with one?
Well,
or do you have to rethink your theory?
So people haven't done that yet. So these two aren't far enough away that you can get it with one number, because the ages aren't that different. This one being younger is a more massive star. And so I haven't yet, I don't know the answer as to whether people have said, let's just say it's a fixed parameter and run all the models, see if it works, or whether they have to vary the parameter. So I don't know the answer right now for this, because these numbers are actually sort of coming in the last few months, actually. So the stellar modelers are now sort of behind.
But they agreed with the distance.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there had already been indications, as I said, actually from this issue, that the age of the Pleiades had to be bigger. Okay. So there were definitely papers from the stellar modelers saying if you want to have everything exactly right, the age can't be 70 megayears. Okay. The difficulty was there was no other bit of evidence to use, and so hopefully the lithium is going to really push things in that direction.
So did I understand correctly, it's the convection? Overshoot.
It's what's called overshoot. The fact that you want the convection to go beyond into the stable region and gather more hydrogen and bring it into the core. That seems to be the main way to do it. Now, you could worry about opacities too, but I'm not going to, people always worry about the opacities. Stan?
Are the new ages consistent with the errors that they found in the top?
Errors they found?
In the top main sequence, the one that were
offset. Oh, yeah.
The new ages are consistent with.
Yeah, so there was a paper by Madera Manet about 5 years ago which put in a fake overshoot parameter and fit it and found all the ages. And actually, these are pretty much what they had. Okay? For a certain model. Parameterized model. So I can't answer the question you were asking about exactly what fraction. So there was already indication, and that was again playing with the model and fitting and all this, trying to fit. But you've got to start, probably a few stars. A star here, one over here. So
this technique can be only used for this age span?
Yeah, that's a good question. The age span is from about 20 to 200. It has to be these stars that are fully convective. So it's from 20 to 200 megayears. And of course, 20 megayear clusters, being young, are rare, and so you have to look further. But they also then tend to be brighter. So there are many other clusters, many. You could probably get 6 on this list within 5 years rather than 3. That's the rate. The rate of progress is about what we've seen.
These new ages have repercussions for our astrophysics or not?
Within clusters, the prime repercussion, one is that it gives evidence that these helium cores are bigger, which will matter for Cepheids. The other place it matters is that there are also white dwarfs in these clusters. And you can, when you see a white dwarf live down here, okay. And when you see a white dwarf, you can actually calculate its age because it lives on just the cooling from the initial heat that it had at birth. Okay, and there was already indications that, for example, one white dwarf in the Pleiades, the age was about 70 million years. So it was already a problem in the sense that it looked like it had to be born at the same day. Okay. So by having these ages, then you can run back, you get the age of the white dwarf, you take 125 minus 70, it tells you what age it was born at, which then tells you what mass star made it. And it's important to know what mass stars can make white dwarfs versus make, say, neutron stars. And so that's the other place where you need the ages.
But for Cepheids, would it make them change the prediction of the distances of other objects which they look at? And they find the Cepheids in the
galaxies. Sure.
And they say, so what was...
the problem with the Cepheid is that the Cepheids, just so you know, there's a strip here where these stars cross it as they're evolving. And so it's these stars that are the Cepheids. So when you look at a mass, when you look at a distant Cepheid, it's a 7 or 8 or 10 solar mass star that's just left the main sequence. And it crosses this instability strip, starts pulsating. So you know the luminosity well. The luminosity, this relation I wrote between the luminosity and mass, actually depends on the fraction of the helium core. Okay? So if there's more helium in the core, the star is actually brighter for its mass than if there's no helium. And so when you want to get the best you can at that scale, you actually need to use a model, an interior model, for that. And so this changes the helium, the mass of the helium core in those stars. And there was already evidence from binaries. There are some Cepheids in binaries where you can get the mass because it's in a binary, and it didn't agree with what the theory would tell you given the luminosity. Okay, so it definitely changes the Cepheids. But that's sort of asking what stars can do for cosmology, which I'd rather ask what we could do for stars. But, yeah. Okay, on that note. Yeah, it ran long.
What?
Ran long.